Socializing and drinking go hand in hand. And across the United States, the hobby of making your own beer and wine has grown in the last few decades. But when it comes to liquor, the law makes it much more difficult to homebrew whiskey, vodka, or rum as a hobby. As a result, there are very few local distilleries across the nation. I'm Maria Carter, and on this Central Standard, we're exploring the culture of micro-distilleries and how these small, locally-owned distilleries have blossomed across the country in the past few years. We'll talk with the first micro-distillery in Kansas, as well as some other local producers of your favorite booze. That's coming up after this hour's news. Good morning. Local wineries and microbreweries have taken off in recent decades. Now the craft alcohol movement is taking a harder turn, with micro-distilleries increasingly getting into the act. Over the past 10 years, craft distilling has undergone a renaissance, from some 70 distillers in the U.S. to around 250 today. I'm Maria Carter, and today on Central Standard, we'll be talking with three local micro-distillers. We're joined by Patrick Garcia, the master distiller at Dark Horse Distillery in Lenexa; Ralph Hayes, the marketing director for Pinckney Bend Distillery out of New Haven, Missouri; and Seth Fox, president of High Plains in Atchison, Kansas. Welcome to all of you.
How are you doing?
Thank you.
Hi.
It's good to have you here. Well, let's start about how you all got started in this. Seth, your distillery, High Plains, was the first in Kansas. Why did that open?
Well, we was looking for a niche. Something that not very many people did, and that just seemed right for us.
And have you always had an interest in, whiskeys and vodkas and hard liquor?
Yeah, I'm the seventh generation that's produced whiskey. I'm the first one that, legally. And, of course, we have number eight and nine generation also with our family. So we're... we've always done with going back to a family reunion. Then that's where I was kind of introduced to really high quality corn liquor. They don't call it moonshine or white lightning.
And so it was a family tradition that you turned into a business in.
Yep.
And how about you, Ralph?
We started as craft brewers. There's three of us, a partnership, and we brewed together as grain brewers for 10 or 12 years, and got good at it. And, my dad had made beer when we were kids, and we had always had a lot of fun associated with the process. And then it was kind of a logical extension. We looked at the economics of getting into the brewery business, and they just weren't there for us. So we proceeded to look carefully at distilling, and the numbers seemed to work. So we said, hey, let's go for it. None of us are spring chickens. Colonel Sanders is my new role model, but we went for it and haven't regretted it for a moment. It's really done well for us.
Well, Seth mentioned that he kind of has a family tradition of distilling. Is it something that you had done before?
I played around with it when I was a kid, and we actually fermented Welch's grape juice and ran it through a homemade still. I think a lot of kids do that. But it wasn't anything that we were serious about. But as we grew older, and I had officially moved to Missouri to become involved in the wine industry, and at one point decided that wasn't, I didn't have the temperament to be a grape grower. I had always sort of been in the excess of alcohol, I guess. Not excess, axis.
Well, and Patrick, how did Dark Horse get started?
Actually, we came together as a family. We were looking for a business to start, and I had worked at a brewery for about 5 years in college. We saw the craft distilling movement kind of coming through the country. It started up, there was a lot more up in the Northwest, and so we started touring different distilleries around the country, kind of getting an idea of what was going on, getting a pulse for the situation. So we decided that this was something that we wanted to do. We did a lot of research before, went to, I went off to classes and stuff like that to learn what it was about. And
where do you go to classes for this?
Actually, we joined an organization called the American Distilling Institute. It's an organization basically for craft distillers. They offer classes, workshops, things like that around the country at different distilleries. So it's definitely a good way to kind of gauge how to get started and what's involved and all that good stuff.
Is it a little scary to make this your business when it's not something that you have a background in?
Yeah, exactly. We did take a leap of faith. You know, we did see the need for Kansas City to have, you know, a local distillery. So, it was, definitely a leap of faith, but, you know, we did it very calculated.
I guess one of the things to me, you know, brewing around here is legal, brewing beer, it can be done legally at home. Distilling, not so much. It's against federal law. I believe Missouri doesn't have a state law against it, but is that kind of a prohibitive thing as far as people getting into this?
Yeah, it is. A lot of people don't know where to cut their teeth. And like when we're at shows and people come, hey, I distill at home. Don't tell anybody. You're not allowed to.
Yeah.
But it happens because, you know, people are acclimated to some of the history in it also. So
The reality of it is that you have to have a license before you undertake this. And the way that's oftentimes accomplished, and we took the same trajectory where we went up to Koval in Chicago, but we were also, one of our partners has a degree in chemistry. We kind of structured our business such that we had the production product development side, and then the sales and marketing side, which I do, and then someone else who does compliance, which is a huge part of what we do. That you don't want to get crossways with the federal or state government, or you can regret it. So that's a big important part of it. But yes, it's not that easy of an industry to get into. When folks ask us how difficult was it, I said it wasn't quite as bad as opening a nuclear power plant, but it certainly was not easy.
Well, let's go through the process of what is distilling, and you know how do we get from grains to, you know, a whiskey or a vodka. Patrick, what's the first step?
Well, we source all of our, we actually bring in raw material, which is grain, you know, corn, rye, soft red, winter wheat. We mill it, we mash it, ferment it, and then we, basically vaporize the alcohol out of that fermented mash with our still. And so that's the process of making alcohol. It's a little bit different than making beer, whereas beer, they take, you know, the liquid. They don't keep all the grain together throughout the whole process. Whereas our process, all the grain, all the water goes from the mash cooker to the fermenter. Then we move everything into the still, and then we, basically bring the alcohol out of that mash, that fermented mash. But then it goes, right at the beginning, from the very beginning, we started putting away bourbon and rye whiskey into charred oak barrels. We brand new American oak barrels, so that, you know, that's where you get the aged whiskey, the bourbons and the rye whiskeys. So it does take some time to sit there. You have to sit there and watch it for many months. So, you know, it's not an easy process. It's a very difficult thing to learn. It's all about taste. And quality. You know,
yeah.
We want to make sure that, you know, everything is clean. Our facility is very clean. Every step of our process is well thought out. So, it's like they were saying before. You know, it's not like creating a starting a nuclear
power plant
or anything like that.
Off.
But it's it's very, you know, it could be unsafe if you're doing it the wrong way.
And is that basically the process for all of the liquors? I know we have gin and vodka and some various whiskeys here. It's the same basic process?
They're all based on the same process. And distillation is based on the fact that alcohol vaporizes at a lower temperature than water. And by controlling the temperature, you cause the alcohol to vaporize, and then you condense that vapor and turn it into a liquid, and that liquid is alcohol.
So pay attention in chemistry
class. Yeah, pay attention in chemistry
class. There's a wide variety of different type of stills, whether it's a fractional column, a simple pot still, or someone's 5-gallon container, or a barrel like they do like in Haiti. They use 55-gallon drums.
Do those affect the final product in different ways?
Yeah, it can. You have to run through many times or really watch what you're doing. So, yeah, a big variety gives you a big variety of quality also.
Well, you're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Maria Carter. Our guests are Patrick Garcia, the master distiller at Dark Horse, Ralph Hayes, the marketing director for Pinckney Bend Distillery, and Seth Fox, president of High Plains. We're discussing the recent growth of local spirits. Kansas City, we have local beer, local wine, and local food. Are you interested in sampling local spirits? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Are people ever surprised that that you're running a distillery? That, you know, this...
Absolutely. I think folks really don't have a good handle on it, and they think distilling is like brewing, and it is in some aspects of it. In that we distillers, brewers, and winemakers have two really important things in common: yeast and cash flow. You know, without yeast we don't have a product. Without cash flow we don't have a business. So. So it all beginning to tie into this whole larger picture of beverage tourism, which is a whole another thing that's very interesting, particularly in our state of Missouri, because we have one of the most liberal states in the union. We're one of only six states that permit us as manufacturers to hold a position on each tier of what is a three-tier system. So we can manufacture, we can distribute, and we can sell at retail, which is, for us small guys, is a real blessing.
And you were mentioning the tourism aspect of things. The town you're in, New Haven, Missouri, I believe, both wine, beer, and
It's a very happy place. We're the only town of 2,000 people that has its own distillery, its own brewery, and its own winery. And we also have a major soft drink bottler. So we're located on the Lewis and Clark Road.
So you can throw quite a party there.
Yes, we can. And we do.
Well, and Seth, we keep on calling your distillery High Plains, but you make the Most Wanted brand of, that's its actual name,
yep.
Most Wanted.
That's our brand.
And that I know it's in quite a few liquor stores in Kansas City.
We produce just under 30,000 cases a year.
Yeah.
And so we started in 2005. And in 2005, people would go, "What, a distillery?" No, you're joking. It's like people were really in disbelief that there was a local, a distillery besides McCormick's, which is the oldest distillery west of the Mississippi, which they're right across the river.
Which is
from
up by Weston.
Yeah, we can almost see them from our place.
Well, and you are in Atchison, so you're kind of banking on that brand of the Atchison, the federal prison, the state prisons that are there.
Well, we started in Leavenworth in 2005.
Okay.
A year later, we moved out to our farm.
Okay.
So being Most Wanted, being in Leavenworth, it kind of went all together. So we just got lucky picking the – you have to pick a brand to start your, distribution. So we fell upon Most Wanted for a variety of reasons.
Well, we've got a few callers. Mike in South Kansas City, good morning.
Yes. Pardon me. I know a little bit, from a consumption of beer – but my question is, how do you distill or, let me say, brew whiskey and vodka and all that how do you try to put a difference in your product versus the other guy?
On vodka, a lot of it is the finishing work to begin with, because all vodka starts at 95% pure alcohol to begin with. And the way people handle it and filter it, some people flavor it or whatever, then that will change a vodka. You get a wide variety of vodkas of even flavor, even though they pretty much start out the same.
And Patrick, you do whiskeys. How do you make those stand out from the others?
Well, actually, we stand out because we are a craft distillery versus, I think he was getting at maybe an industrial distillery, such as like a Jim Beam or larger distillery. So everything is small batch, whatever we make. So we're able to actually make a cut between the bad alcohol, the good alcohol. You know, all of the good alcohol goes into our barrels. So whereas a larger distillery, and they put everything into a barrel. You know, they don't really have a way to make maybe a heads or tails cut. Whereas we're putting all of the hearts into barrels. You know, we make great cuts, and you know, that shows up in the end product.
I think small batch has a lot to do with it. For example, I mean, our gin product, we handle all the botanicals separately, and in some we macerate and distill, others we suspend in the vapor column. And as a result, it gives us a flavor profile that to gin aficionados would be described as juniper bright, or not just juniper forward, but a very fresh, crisp juniper with a firm citrus backbone. We do all that by essentially how we handle and essentially finish the spirit. We blend gin is a neutral spirit like a vodka with a very specific and historically recognized flavor profile. So we again do ours by small batches, and you know, as he said, it's a lot of it is where you do the cuts, and the tighter you cut, the purer the spirit. It's the tail cuts are what they call congeners, and you can leave more or less tail cuts in there if you want to build more character into your product.
Okay, well, let's take another caller. Good morning, Mike from Lee's Summit.
Good morning. You'd mentioned earlier about how the federal law still restricts home distilling. I was wondering if there was any kind of movement to removing or repealing some of those laws, and would you see that as a good thing for home distilling and obviously kind of the growth of the micro distilling business?
Yes, I would. I think it'd be a tremendous thing. I think people ought to be allowed to do largely what they want to do. There are places on the planet like New Zealand where people distill all the time, and I don't see any reason except for the law why we shouldn't and couldn't. But yes, I would strongly support that.
Is there any? I know it is not legal, but you mentioned people telling you that they distill when you go to some like festivals and different things. Is there any sense that this is a growing movement at home, or you know, that people are doing more distilling?
People are realizing, hey, I can do this. You can buy pretty much everything on the internet. Of course, there's that nice little thing of the permitting. A lot of them just oversee. Most of the time, the large moonshiners, ones they're after. I wish they would make it legal, because all other countries, you send a simple $10 permit in, and you can actually do it at home. I think that would help a lot.
I guess the only thing that I would worry about is, you know, just the safety involved. Mm-hmm. It could be an unsafe situation, but yeah, if somebody has been doing it for a long time, you know, especially some of the moonshiners or some people that have had it passed down in their family, or you know, they learn from somebody else. But
and what are some of those safety issues?
Oh, you know, alcohol is very flammable. Number one, you know, it comes off at a very high proof, and then also the like what we were talking about before, the cuts between the different alcohols, it could be poisonous if you have too much of bad alcohol going into your product. So
because of the fusel oils that come out, actually will attack your retina and make you blind.
Yeah, so. Which is part of the reason, you know, you hear about bathtub gins and different things that, you know, that
a lot of that in the old days during Prohibition anyway, yeah. They were using car radiators, which were soldered together with lead. But I think, you know, when you look at the history of distilling, distilling was an adjunct process to farming. Before the Civil War, early part of the 19th century, I read a figure the other day that said there were probably 14,000 stills operating in the United States in 1830. So farmers did this. It was considered a regular thing. It wasn't until much later that it, till after the Civil War when we had this huge debt that we had to pay, that the excises came in.
And 1791 is when we passed that. The whiskey tax.
The taxes always bring in the regulations,
yeah.
Right?
It's all about the revenue, I think, yeah. As far as federal government's concerned.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a way to, tax that, I'm sure the government might be more open to letting people.
Well, if you propose a system by which they could make 25 gallons a year and they have to send in their $13.50 per proof gallon federal tax ahead of time,
it's about the revenue also. Yeah. It generates a lot of revenue, help pay the debt off for the Revolutionary War, and that was a good. It was pushed off as a sin tax when they first enacted it in 1791. So. That's how, like today, it's still political. Nothing much has changed. They push off a certain tax. Hey, this is evil. We need to tax it. And it actually worked. Everybody conformed to it. So,
well, right now, we have two people from Kansas. Is it easier to open a distillery in Kansas or Missouri?
Missouri.
Yeah.
What makes it easier there?
Licensing. Missouri is one of six states, as I said, that is really very liberal about it. We can get license. You can get a liquor license a lot of places, and as I said, we can hold any position on a three-tier system, any or all. But the other part is taxes are lower. I mean, we're only paying $2 a proof gallon state tax, as opposed to Seth. What were you saying?
We're $2.50 a wine gallon, which is still very reasonable.
So in the Washington operation you were talking about?
Oh, yeah. Washington State, they're close to $20 a wine gallon.
I was just visiting my sister there, and it is much more expensive to pick up any sort of liquor.
But
there.
Kansas isn't necessarily a hard state. They're actually very nice to work with, very easy to get in. Now, a fun fact about Kansas is still not ratified the 21st Amendment.
Oh, no.
So they went prohibition in Kansas in 1881 until 1948. So they were much more stringent than any other state. They were the first to go prohibition, too.
I know Kansas recently changed some laws around liquor laws.
Micro-distillery.
Yeah, when we opened our distillery, we saw the need for, we wanted to do sampling. As a manufacturer, we could not actually offer sampling to people coming through. So, we did work with the legislators and were able to actually, it was a perfect storm because the retailers wanted to have sampling in Kansas also. So we were able to come together and come to an agreement on sampling and tourism. So it's definitely, Kansas sees it as a benefit for their state, they see it as a benefit, and so the laws have been loosened. So we're able to do manufacturing, we're able to do tourism, we're able to sample people coming through our distillery, and that's a big key for our business. For people to see what we do and how we do it, and come and taste and see for yourself.
Well, I know, especially like tasting rooms are big at a lot of breweries. Is that part of how you hope to sell your product, is getting people in there and giving it a try?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of it. People come and see the awesome, huge copper still and see all of our stainless steel fermenters. That's a big draw, if we can, offer them a sample while we're there, they're a captive audience, and we want people to, know what we're about and, show them how we do it. And, it's a very really neat and cool thing to, actually make alcohol.
If someone comes for a tour like that, are they actually able to buy the bottle of whiskey there, or do they have to go somewhere else for that?
Yeah, they're in that big law change. There was a souvenir package sale, so yeah, we are able to sell souvenir packages. But we do direct people to the liquor stores, the local liquor stores, because we would rather them visit them and not come in and just to buy alcohol from us. It's a part of the experience.
Yeah.
It's a part of the experience. But yeah, they could walk out with a souvenir bottle.
And the rest of you do tastings and tours as well?
We will starting in July. There's what's called, in Missouri, there's what's called a legal Missouri pour. It's a quarter ounce metered pour. And we can pour those all day long in grocery stores or wherever any place that has a liquor license, and places that don't have a liquor license. It's really very easy in Missouri to sample your product compared to other states.
Or I'm a little bit different. I'm not under the micro distillery law. We give tours on demand. People request it. We don't have our nearest neighbors over a mile away, so we're kind of middle of nowhere. So we also can't sell on premise. We sell only through the three tier system in Kansas.
So they would have to go to a liquor store and buy that.
Right. We can give them a taste.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've actually had Greyhound buses pull up for a lot of people, you know, coming for tours, which is really fun to do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's take one quick call before we go to break. Russ in Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning. Quick question about something you said earlier. It had always been my understanding that it was legal to make distilled grain spirits, for one's own consumption or that of one's family, as differentiated from giving and or selling it off with less than, I think it was 20 or 25 gallons a year or something like that. Am I incorrect in this? I mean, I know it's one thing to avoid making methanol by mistake, but I always thought at least it was legal. I'll take my answer via FM. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Russ.
That's a common myth. You can only make 200 gallons of wine or beer for self-consumption, 100 gallons per adult in a house, but you cannot distill one single drop under federal law.
And in Missouri, it is legal. The gentleman's right and wrong. In Missouri, it is legal by state law, but it's absolutely illegal by federal law, and federal law trumps.
I'd be much more scared of the feds in general.
Yeah, a bigger stick.
Yeah. Okay, well, we are going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be taking your calls and continuing our discussion of local distilleries. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Maria Carter. Our guests are Patrick Garcia, the master distiller at Dark Horse, Ralph Hayes, the marketing director for Pinckney Bend Distillery, and Seth Fox, president of High Plains. We're discussing the recent growth of local spirits and the challenges and highly regulated business in that they are. Kansas City, have you ever dabbled in home brewing? What are the biggest challenges and what are some of the things you've learned? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Or you can post to Facebook. Let's go ahead. Lisa has been hanging on the line for a minute or two over the break, so let's give her a shout out. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Good morning. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Very interesting, your topic. I was interested in also knowing that you all are manufacturers and you distribute probably something else. So I was wondering how difficult was that process of getting licensed? Because I am I manufacture lotions and that type of thing, and some other, you know, body products. So I'm wanting to ask, is it difficult as far as getting licensed? I know I can get licensed with the permit, but I'm concerned about the patenting process. I don't know if you've had to go through that.
It's somewhat similar to like FDA, which I assume you're under. Although I can say the TTB is really nice to work. They're very proactive, very good.
And what's
good
the TTB?
People. That's the part of the ATF and the Treasury Department that handles the permitting of federal permitting. The states, people say, you're in Kansas, isn't that really hard? And it's like, I really can't say that. They're very nice people. All I like is they're proactive. They help you. They don't want to see you fail. But there is a pretty lengthy process of the federal permit and then the state permit and then your formulas and then getting label approval. And then the biggest hurdle, your distribution.
Is that just a lot of paperwork to fill out and a lot of details?
Right. Out of 10 people, we have 2 full-time people that just handles all the paperwork.
Wow. So about 20% of your labor goes to paperwork.
It drives the business, yeah.
Is that about true for the rest of you?
Yeah, it's a huge part of it. And I think the issue isn't so much as it's difficult as it's very complex. And it takes a long time to do. And there's a lot of stuff that you have to collect. And I know in our operation, thank heavens, we had 3 guys working on it because we would tag team some of this when somebody just pulls their hair out. And I mean, the laws are very specific. And you have to meet them, and there's no leeway. You either do or you don't.
And if you don't, you're not making anything, I take it.
Right.
Okay. Well, we have another caller, Jim from Overland Park. Good morning.
Good morning. I was born and raised in Kentucky, and I was always under the impression that the term bourbon was a trademark term that was reserved for a product made in Kentucky, but one of your guests used that term, so I'm obviously mistaken.
Well, Patrick, how about you address that?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
The question about bourbon and whether it's a trademark term.
No, it's a recipe. It used to be, it came from Bourbon County, but no, it's definitely the recipe of has to be at least the government mandated this, that it has to be at least 51% corn. It goes into a brand new American oak barrel, but it's more about the recipe. We use a traditional recipe at our distillery, and but it definitely we also use the sour mash recipe process, which means that you start with some back set from the previous distillation. So it's all about the process and all about the recipe.
Okay, well, we're going to get our producer, Matthew Long Middleton, out here in a minute, and maybe we can taste some bourbon and compare that to some other types of whiskey and just get a little taste for that. But, I think that is something that is confusing for a lot of people, especially when it comes to whiskey.
And it is confusing. I mean, you can make anything you want, but you cannot, by law, call it anything you want. Our Bible is what's called BAM, the Beverage Alcohol Manual, and that there are very, very specific, and every label has to be approved by the Fed or by TTB or COLA. It's called COLA approval, and bourbon. The requirements for bourbon are, as Patrick said, it has to be at least 51%. But if it's going to call it corn whiskey, it has to be at least 80% corn. You said something earlier that I thought was great. All bourbon is corn whiskey, but not all corn whiskey is bourbon.
Yeah, well, all corn whiskey is 80%. There's actually 41 different types of whiskey. People are very surprised to hear that. There's roughly four different types.
No wonder no one knows what bourbon. Each type is.
Right. So to go to tasting, people know everything about beer and wines. But when it comes to spirits, they know very little. It's very fun to educate them and talk to them about the variety that you have. And then the particular differences on, like, bourbon can only be produced in the United States because it's indigenous to the United States, which is corn, where, you know, Scotch is from Scotland. So it's very interesting to talk to them about the different varieties.
Well, do you ever have people come up to you and say, well, I don't really like whiskey, or, and then...
That's a hard nut to crack.
Yeah. Is it just something that they haven't tried a good whiskey, or they've only tried it once and just determined that's not for them?
It's primarily marketing. The whiskey, if your relatives drunk a particular brand of whiskey, especially out of Kentucky, they assume all whiskey's from Kentucky, then it's hard to get them to try something new. Vodka drinkers will try just about anything you put in front of them, and they're very easy to switch to one another because they're roughly the same. But whiskeys are so varied, it's like wines, to where they get really particular on their style. So it can be very hard.
Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of sampling at a lot of liquor stores, and, you know, people will have a preconceived notion of what whiskey tastes like. You know, the dark color sometimes, you know, throws people off. The difference between our bourbon and our rye whiskey, I mean, the rye has got that spice, that spicy note, you know. But, you know, also people are used to all those big brands in the market, you know. And once they do try some of the small batch, the craft distilled whiskeys, you know, we have been able to change their mind. You know, we've turned people into, you know, liking even mixed cocktails. You know, you don't have to just drink it straight. You know, we have, you know, yeah. There's a lot of old fashioned cocktail. There's a drink called an old fashioned, but a lot of cocktails. We do concentrate on also making cocktails with our drinks. You know, because a lot of people just don't like to drink it straight. They want to mix it. You know, so. We have a large list of cocktails that we have come up with, and we're even out at the Royal Stadium now with our cocktails. You know, we have a couple of booze there that do serve dark horse cocktails.
So. And so we've got our producer, Matthew Long Middleton, here, and he is ready to sample some of, I believe, Patrick, your...
Our bourbon.
Your bourbon. Yeah.
All right. So thank you, Maria.
Walk him through this.
Our bourbon is aged for about a year and a half. We use a lot of 10-gallon, 30-gallon barrels for this first batch. But it's about 80% corn, 20% rye, and it's got a good caramel flavor, vanilla flavor, smokiness.
And how long does this typically age?
It just depends on the size of the barrel. That's a mm-hmm. big part of the aging process. You know, you need to have
the right surface area, I'd assume.
Exactly. The right surface area of wood versus the spirit inside.
Okay. So, and this is the bourbon?
This is the bourbon.
Yeah. All right.
And what do you think?
That's really delicious.
good.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for corn-based, you know, alcohol. Like the sweetness of it is mm-hmm. is really really nice.
Good. Yeah, it's got a good smooth flavor.
Nice vanilla notes. Getting the butterscotchy kind of elements that come from the
That's not like, are those separate ingredients that you guys are adding? No, that's just like the process of
it. It comes from the oak. Mainly the oak, but you know the corn gives it that some flavor. The rye gives it some flavor. The yeast can give it some flavor too, but a lot of that comes from the aging process. It pulls that. It interacts with the wood, mm-hmm. interacts with that charred wood, and that's where you get the vanillas, the caramels, the cherries, the apples, but then it makes that complex flavor that you're tasting right now.
So how much? Like, I guess one question is like, how much of what I was tasting was like your oak selection? Like how much of this is like, well, we got to get this exact oak from this region of, you know, like, or is it just like you kind of.
Well, they say that Missouri oak is the best.
Not only the best, but almost all the whiskey made in the United States and nearly all the whiskey made in Scotland is aged in Missouri oak barrels. And this is something we can be very proud of. In Scotland, you know, they age Scotch whiskey in used American bourbon barrels. The standard whiskey barrel is 52 gallons, I believe. We both use smaller than standard because we're the economics of small distillery operation are you know you make clear spirits and you can move them to market right away, whereas these spirits you invest in making the spirit and putting it in a barrel and invest in a barrel and then you have to wait. But with what you're tasting there, and that's a very very nicely made whiskey that Patrick poured for us and. The grain bill for the Pinckney Bend corn whiskey is 20% corn, 15 barley, 5 rye.
But this is totally clear. Like it almost looks like water.
It's not seen a barrel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Barrels are the magic, I think, of whiskey. They're the magic part.
Okay. So this is no barrel, totally clear. This is the corn whiskey from Pinckney Bend.
Right.
Wow, that is, it's deceptively smooth.
Exactly.
Like all my college years, it always hurt at the end of it, but that was like very, very pleasant to drink. And it didn't have, you're right, those flavors of vanilla or, you know, apple or sweetness.
It's corn on the palate, corn in the nose, and we you know, cutting is part of what we do, and we cut tightly.
What do you mean by cutting?
When whiskey starts... When alcohol starts running from the still, the first alcohols to come off are the lighter alcohols, and there's nothing in there that is worthwhile. It's all bad tasting, and some of it's even dangerous, and it makes good charcoal lighter. Then after the heads come a hearts, what's called a heart cut, and the heart cut is all predictable within specific temperature ranges, but you can confirm it by the taste. And the heart cut is all the stuff you want, and then towards the end of that, there's what's called
and again you're separating these using
absolutely you're separating them in different you have a little valve or mm-hmm. however everybody does it differently.
We have a spirit receiver we can make the cuts. You know, there's different parts of that spirit receiver it's separated into three compartments. There's different compartments that you can separate it out into, so it doesn't get mixed.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Maria Carter. Our guests are Patrick Garcia, the master distiller at Dark Horse, Ralph Hayes, the marketing director for Pinckney Bend Distillery, and Seth Fox, president of High Plains. We're discussing the recent growth of local spirits. And Kansas City, are you thinking of getting into the distilling business? Do you have a question for our expert entrepreneurs? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And Dennis, are you still there? Okay, we lost Dennis, and he had a question about the temperatures that you distill at. We were talking about that just a little bit. But is there an industry standard, or does that one of your production secrets that goes into
every
it?
Every still is a little bit different. Alcohol vaporizes at 173 degrees Fahrenheit. Our particular still, we start getting off at 200, and we do not never go above 208 because then you get the fusel oil. So every still is unique, has characteristics of its own, how you run it. You just learn that.
And we were talking a little bit about the Missouri oak. Do you source your other ingredients locally? I know we're kind of in the heart of the Corn Belt here. Do you make a point to buy local ingredients?
We do. Our corn comes locally in the Atchison area. Although the barley malt part comes from the northern states. So all the malting is done up in Wisconsin, Minnesota.
And Ralph?
No, we don't. It just wasn't a part of our business plan, and we don't. It just hasn't worked out for us.
Sometimes you got to get the ingredients
well,
where
I
they
mean,
are.
We have there's a distillery that just opened. It's only 30 miles from us, called Mad Buffalo, and their business concept is grain to glass. Not only are they sourcing local grain, they're only making grain from what they grow on their farm.
Wow.
So everybody's Seth's business plan is different from ours, and everybody has a different one. So it's a matter of what works for you.
We definitely try to source local whenever it's possible. We use Bartlett grain for, they're located here on the plaza, but we use our corn is number one yellow corn. It's cleaned and separated, so it does go to their cleaning facility for it to be the best quality that we can get. So yeah. Everybody has a different way of a different business plan, and we also get our grains in 2,000-pound bags. So some people use 50-pound bags of grain, and sometimes it's hard for a local farmer to put the grain in a 2,000-pound bag and make it shippable for a distillery like us.
And we mentioned the different business models. How much? How much whiskey and other spirits are you making a year?
It's hard to say per year. We just added a second shift. We're going on about almost a year, about 10 months now with the second shift. But we make like the bourbon has more corn, so you get more alcohol from corn than you do from rye. There's more starch in corn, so we'll make about 50 to anywhere from 50 to 100. Gallons a day of alcohol, so it's hard to say though on a if you multiply that, but yeah, like I said, we just added a second shift, so we have increased our production.
And Ralph, how about you guys?
I think from our standpoint, we're smaller than these guys, and I think probably not as well funded, but we're producing right now about 75-100 cases a week.
Well, on yearly, we do about a little under 30,000 cases. And people are amazed because we're only about 7,500 square feet, 9 people, that we can get the throughput out. But, yeah, we have started in 2005, so that helps.
Yeah, so you have that experience. You have some of that.
Yeah, and when we started out, people are amazed because we were dead broke. I mean, absolutely. When we sipped our first pallet, we had less than $100 in all our accounts. We threw everything at this, and it ended up paying off.
Well, I mean, you say you're dead broke. What made you decide, kind of, it was pretty untested at that time. There weren't a lot of other micro distilleries.
There was
around.
92 working distilleries when we got in. Well, we can live on what falls through the cracks from the big distilleries, and that's what we presumed. And we can make a better quality product at a lower price. and because we only had, at the time, I only had two kids to feed. our concept was only sell 30 cases a week.
So,
you know, just to pay the bills.
And so that's what it took to pay the bills at the
time.
Right.
And at the time, I mean, I'm very comfortable working with any federal regulations under CFR. So, I mean, I felt comfortable with it.
Okay. Well, we've got some callers who want to find out a little bit more. Nancy from Liberty, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And what's your question?
I just had a question about barrels. You always talk about oak barrels. Do you ever put things in other kinds of, or does someone put things in other kind of barrels, hickory barrels, some other kind of barrels? Or is there something special about oak?
I think there is something very special about oak. But the answer to your question is yes. There's a number of different kinds of barrels that people experiment with, and you know, there's a brand called Bastille, which is a single malt that's made in France, where they do in Limousin oak barrels. But and there's another distiller in St. Louis called Square One, where they actually use cherry wood barrels. I'd love to get my hands on a sherry barrel and put some of my malt whiskey in that. But yes, the answer to your question is their oak is the standard, and it's proven to do an excellent job. But people, the nice part about the craft distilling industry is all the creativity in this business is coming from the craft guys.
Except you are limited under all whiskeys have to be in an oak barrel under federal law.
So you have to call it something else.
Except for corn, everything else has to go in the oak barrel, at least for an amount of time. After that, you can handle it however you wish.
Okay, well, let's take another call. James from Raytown, good morning.
Hello there. I had a question about malting. What does that mean?
That's where you take a grain, the seed, and you sprout it. As soon as it sprouts, usually double or two times the length of the sprout, then you dry it. And the sprouting action causes enzymes, natural occurring enzymes in the seed, and that the enzymes is what snaps the long starch molecules from your corn, potatoes, whatever, into small sugar molecules.
Well, that is I just learned something right there. and we have another caller, John from Independence. Good morning.
Good morning. A few minutes ago when you were talking about sourcing local grain versus non-local grain and things like that, it just got me curious. Since so much of corn nowadays is genetically modified, does that have any impact on your decisions? Does it have any impact on the flavor?
Does anyone specifically source non-GMO corn? Or
I have certified organic corn that we produce a product with. It's twice as expensive, but it gives a little bit different product.
We have our Ryder vodka, which is actually organic. It's all organic wheat, but it's hard to say on what our grain broker is doing with that. But you know, we try to stipulate those. You know, we want the best quality. So. That's something to think about.
There's a problem with sourcing non-GMO is that a non-GMO field would have to be really, really isolated from a GMO field, and I'm not sure that's really possible because you cannot stop the fertilization that occurs between the pollen of a GMO field and the corn in a non-GMO field. So it gets dicey.
Okay, and well, let's take one more quick call, and then we'll do another tasting here. Maybe some of the most wanted that we—I don't think we've tasted that yet. Mary from Brookside.
Hi, this is Mary, and
a quick question, please.
I'm calling to just find out. My son's getting married in Dearborn, Missouri. We're having a lot of local home brews as well as homemade wine, and I was wondering where. Can we find your different, you know, vodkas or your, you know, whatever, booze or whatever kind you're selling, whiskeys or whatnot? Are they selling locally?
We have on dhdistillery.com. We have a large list of all the retailers locally on the Kansas and Missouri side. So you can just go right there, and you could probably find one right around the corner.
We're in Red X, we're in Gomer's, we're in Cosentino's. We're pretty generally available in Kansas City.
Most of the major stores in Kansas City metropolitan area as hard as we're in about 700, a little over 720 stores in Kansas. So you can, if they don't have it, don't ask for it, demand it, please.
Yes, I'm definitely. Sure that goes for all of you, right?
Yes, you bet.
Okay, well, let's do a tasting of one of the most wanted. Can I get one, too, since we're at the end of the show?
Yeah. Celebrate.
Okay, and what are we drinking here?
This is a vanilla ice cream vodka.
Oh, okay. A flavored vodka. Okay.
You want to do that one?
Sure.
There you go.
Okay, well, let's give this a try. And how do you, while I'm doing taking this drink, how do you flavor a vodka?
Well, on the flavored vodkas, you usually add natural oils and essence in order to get where you want.
And it definitely smells very vanilla-y. And it has a vanilla flavor, although...
I feel like I'm drinking ice cream.
You put it in anything, you make a float out of it.
Yeah, I was going to say...
It's a dangerous float.
That's right. It's an adult root beer float.
Well, I know there are several restaurants and bars around town where you can order shakes and such that have hard liquors in them. And
that people get very creative.
Yeah. Well, and are you finding that more and more people, I know a lot of the major brands have, you know, marshmallow vodkas and various flavors now. Is that something that's in demand?
Yes, it is. In fact, we have three flavored vodkas, and we're adding more. We have 10 products currently on the market in 6 different sizes. So but you can only do so much. Like you see Smirnoff with like 25 different flavors. Well, they have the finances to do that. But to launch just a single brand and single cost quite a bit.
I think it's kind of driving the retailers and mixologists crazy.
Yeah.
Because they all of a sudden, instead of just one, you have to have, you know, you have 15 different SKUs for one vodka producer. So our approach has been, we make a vodka, you flavor it.
Okay. Well, whatever your approach to spirits is, our guests today were Patrick Garcia, the master distiller at Dark Horse Distillery in Lenexa, Ralph Hayes, the marketing director for Pinckney Bend Distillery out of New Haven, Missouri, and Seth Fox, president of High Plains in Atchison, Kansas. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in here and sharing with us. And you can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore lowrider car culture. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Claire McInerney. Up to Date is next with psychologist Wes Crenshaw and SNL star and Kansas native Jason Sudeikis. I'm Maria Carter, and this is Central Standard.